Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are streaming on the web at ksfr.org, and this show is podcasting on the internet at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show any time of day thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show at iTunes. I'd like now to welcome Natasha Schull. She is a fellow at the International Center for Advanced Studies at New York University. Her book, Machine Life, Control and Compulsion in Las Vegas, will be coming out later this year, and she's about to become a professor at MIT this fall. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. The gambling industry, now called the gaming industry, which is what you study, has changed dramatically in the last century or so. Let's talk about that. What were a gambler's choices? What did a gambler do 100 years ago compared to now?
Well, in Las Vegas 100 years ago, it was really radically different. There were no machines. That's really the main difference that I focus on in my research, is the introduction of slot machine technology and its real takeover of the whole industry. I think today...
Or were they playing cards?
They were playing cards, yes. And it was mainly men, and it was in these smoky back rooms or second floors of little places that kind of tried to stay out of the public view because they were really seen as a kind of vice, moral vice.
And what about roulette wheels?
Yep, that was there too. It was really mainly focused on cards, though. It was less of an entertainment complex with varied games and really centered on... table games that involve social interaction between men.
Very interesting. And now the changes that have come with technology are not only that you have machines, but that the machines work very, very fast.
Yes, they work very fast. They're played not in a social context, but just you and the machine, as the gamblers always like to tell me, that's actually what they're after. So there's been this real shift in what in the industry is known as action gambling to escape gambling. And you have women playing now in great numbers. Women were traditionally known as being the escape gamblers, and the slot machine technology was originally introduced to kind of keep the wives of the card players happy. Now more and more men are playing and shifting to machines as well. So,
now you study the gambling industry, the gaming industry, the people who make these machines, the people who sell them at trade shows, and I read the article that you wrote about this, and to me it was absolutely shocking. I mean, they make machines where you don't have to pull a lever, but rather push a button, because pulling a lever takes 6 seconds and pushing a button takes 1 second.
Right. And now, I mean, that changes like that were introduced in the 1980s and really became the industry standard in the 90s. Now they've shifted on to changes that speed up play even more. You don't have to press a button. You just press a screen. And sometimes the screen can sense your finger's proximity before you actually even touch it. So that's really what the entire industry is mobilized around, is how to speed up and accelerate technology to extend play, increase the amount that you're playing, and speed up your play.
So your play is speeded up, you're playing for a longer time. There's also movement from using coins to using bills and credit cards.
Yes. Bill acceptors came in the 1990s and with credit play. So you just put in a $100 bill and you play off your credits, so you're not stopping to feed in coins one at a time. So with that, plus not pulling a handle, pulling a button, it's just incredible. I think it used to be on traditional machines that at top speed you could play maybe 300 hands an hour. And now if you're rushing along, you can play 900. On video poker machines.
And what that comes out to every 3 seconds or every 5 seconds or something is another
thing. It's something phenomenal like that. And some of the designers are even astounded at how fast the gamblers that they're making this technology for can play. They say, I can't even play that fast, and I designed the thing.
And yeah, right, exactly. So there's a movement from bills to coins, from large motions to small motions. Another piece of it is that they've designed chairs that are really comfortable so your legs never fall asleep.
Right. It's not just the actual game technology. It's features in the larger environment, one of them being this shift to kind of ergonomic design. So there's a focus on these chairs that pay meticulous attention to things like circulation, especially for elderly folks who are playing these games in large numbers. How can we make them sit there longer without their legs falling asleep? Things like this. What angle should we tilt the screen at? Should it be tilted at 36 degrees instead of 48 degrees, because then you don't get player fatigue as quickly. So things like this. There's also attention to sound. Physicists come on board to kind of go through the casino and meter different sound conditions throughout, and which sound conditions are most conducive to extending play and reducing what they call player fatigue.
And so the idea is to get people to sit there for as long as they possibly can and spend the most amount of money they possibly can.
Yes, and they call this time on device, and they have expressions they use like player extinction. Player extinction is really what they're after. So it's really quite surreal.
Player extinction?
Yes, meaning that their aim is to deplete your budget. So the only time that it's really acceptable for the person to leave the machine when they've done the really successful job is when they're zeroed out, when they have lost their last penny.
I mean, it gets more nefarious, too, because there are ways of bypassing the $300 a day limit on your bank card.
Yes, there's all of these other features. It's not just the sound and the chairs and the game structure. It's hooking up through wireless devices and interconnectivity with bank institutions and credit cards so that you can really just dip right into your savings. So it's not like you go to the casino anymore with actual money on you that you can zero out. You can actually dip into your monies in the bank on credit cards, money that you don't even have yet, really. Put it on credit.
And they can track through your credit cards not only how much money you're gambling, but what you do afterwards, how many drinks you have, what hotel you're staying at, what you buy in the convenience store.
Right, that's done really through what's called player loyalty cards, which kind of built on the gaming industry is interesting because it sort of pilfers and takes things from other industries. From the internet, player
reward. Oh, so it's not
reward
through credit cards. I was wondering because
no.
I was wondering what the privacy limitations
right.
were.
The player cards actually came out of frequent flyer cards when airlines started doing that. So they said, "Hey, how can we, poach this technology and apply it to this entertainment context?" So it's really through player loyalty cards, which are hooked up to lines of credit cards, etc. But through those, they can really track your movement throughout a property or networked properties and learn just everything about you, including how you like to play. And Harrah's, for instance, has a program of player tracking where they can establish for each player what they call it a pain point. What is that threshold where for you, it turns into something not fun where you're likely to get up and go. And if they can sense in real time that you're approaching your pain point, they can spontaneously generate what they call real-time rewards. So this is not actually the game shifting its terms, because that would go against regulations. It's sort of compensating for that regulatory restriction by coming up to you and saying, here's a free meal ticket, or having something on the machine that would generate a meal ticket, or coming over, a luck ambassador would be dispatched, a live casino employee, to give you a coupon for 10 extra dollars or something to keep you there, everything to keep you there.
We're talking to Natasha Schull. You write about reward schedules to select for specific player profiles. Now, reward schedules, is that what you were just talking about?
Well, reward schedules are a little different. You could see this kind of real-time rewards of vouchers for meal tickets or shows as being part of the larger reward schedule. But that's really a behaviorist term that came with B.F. Skinner, etc., in his behaviorist his theory of
rewarding rats when they pushed a lever, right?
The rats or Pavlov's dogs or things like this. So the reward schedule is really how the game is encoded. And the reward schedule that most games follow is called the intermittent variable ratio reinforcement schedule. And what that means is that you never know how much you're getting and you never know when. And within that
meaning how much you're winning in the gambling game that you're playing.
Right. So it's sustaining a kind of sense of uncertainty. And this, you know, it works for all animals. For rats, they become addicted most quickly to a substance if they never know how much they're getting and they never know when, because it kind of keeps them there pressing the lever. And so that's really right. What's going on. And then within that general formula, there are people, there are profiles who need more rewards more frequently to keep them there and get them addicted than others who are really willing to sit there longer to go for a larger reward. So they don't need such constant reinforcement.
So if I'm a type that needs constant reinforcement, the machine will recognize that from my playing style or whatever. In some way, they'll recognize that. And then I'll get more small wins in my gambling game?
The machines, again, because of restrictions, are not actually able yet to tailor themselves to you in real time, although there are shifts to that with downloadable games, because the machines really come with a programmed chip, a chip that is pre-programmed. But what they can do with all of this player tracking software is really get such a sense of player profiles that they're able to design banks of machines that will appeal two different player profiles, so you're likely to seek those games out. So everyone can go into the casino and kind of find the machines that suit them. And then those machines are likely to operate in a way that will keep you at them the longest. So it's almost like the whole casino is like a little ecology that selects for different profiles and tries to cover all ground and all the range of different people playing.
Now, when you have a roulette wheel, unless the thing is weighted somehow, it's random what's going to happen. It's going to land on any given number at random. When you have a computer full of random number generators, you know, your number, I mean, what's to say that it's not programmed in such a way that you cannot possibly ever win?
Well, it is programmed. The algorithms, I mean, it's quite complicated, but they do run on random number generators. But this does not actually mean totally random that you can win and that there's an equal footing with the house, because the algorithms that those random number generators are working within have already determined that the house has an edge. So that's really how it works. And machines do advertise, you know, this is an 80% payback or a 90% payback machine. So technically, you have to be upfront in the casino industry with the consumers about the likelihood of winning.
So it means it'll take 10 or 20% of whatever you put into
it. Yeah, over the long haul, you will get back 90% of what you put in.
Right, right. Now, the industry uses terms like productivity to express a gambler sitting down for the longest time and spending the most money in the shortest amount of time. That's a kind of perversion of language.
It's a perversion of language, but at the same time, I think it's a direct carryover from, for example, factory labor, where there was such a concern. I mean, you see so many of the same things brought over into the entertainment complex in this consumer society that we live in today, being brought over from the more industrial production kind of context, where you are really concerned with speeding up the motion of the workers along the assembly line and how to keep them working at those machines for the longest time possible.
But I mean, at the end, a car comes out in the factory. At the end of this, all that comes out is that their pockets are empty.
Their pockets are empty. The casino industry, though, cultivates a rhetoric of entertainment as a kind of intangible product, that really this is about fun, excitement, entertainment. And the idea is, and the language that they use to legitimize this, is that we have an entertainment budget, and all they're doing is kind of taking that they're not taking away from other monies, that they're taking away from the leisure budget of the consumer.
What's it called? Excess income? Disposable income.
Yes.
However,
so when they say things like player extinction, they can then, and you press them on that, they then turn around and say, oh no, we don't want to take the milk money, we just want the entertainment budget. But really, when you talk to them, they'll slip up when they get carried away, and it's really they're after just extinguishing your resources in general.
And I mean, everybody knows there's tremendous problems with gambling addiction, and this seems to be the cultivation of the absolute maximum gambling addiction.
It really does, and that's why this rhetoric, it seems, you know, I met a lot of these guys in my research.
The guys who make the machines.
I was hanging out with gamblers, and I was hanging out with the technology engineers, and kind of looking at, people have looked at one side or the other, but not what's the interface there. How do these people who are making the machines think about it and talk about it in their own minds, and then how do the players actually interact? What is that interface there? And, you know, they're really nice guys, the designers, and interesting. Some of them are gamblers themselves. And I didn't get a sense of evil empire, you know, and it wasn't like they had B.F. Skinner's theory of operant conditioning sitting in their desk side table. It wasn't like that. But that becomes actually more nefarious in a way, because there's this whole rhetoric that sustains and justifies what really, quite factually, does come down to maximizing addiction.
And you talk to a lot of players.
Absolutely. That was the majority of my research, was spending time talking to players, sort of everyday players and players in Gamblers Anonymous settings and other kind of clinical settings throughout Las Vegas. It was mostly focused on residents who were going to be playing a lot rather than the tourists who are coming in and out of town.
And there's a lot of residents who get addicted to gambling in Las Vegas.
Yes.
Now, that you talk about, some of them seem to really enjoy what they're doing. They talk about going into the zone.
Mm-hmm. Zone, however, I wouldn't use the word enjoyment to describe it. And that's really where there's this disjuncture between the rhetoric of enjoyment, entertainment, fun, that's really this product that the industry is supplying. And the experience that gamblers describe. They are talking about escaping more than enjoyment. They're not really fully present when they're in the zone to experience anything like enjoyment. It's almost like an erasing of the self. So they're zoning out.
Well, this is the thing that I wondered. I mean, what are the human needs and desires that are being fulfilled, albeit in a false and not really fulfilling way, by these machines?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that's a complicated question, and there's probably many answers to it. But I think you can see, as a cultural anthropologist, if I'm to come along and make anything more than more cultural than a kind of psychological explanation based on each individual, it does seem that there is a trend in our culture toward escape activities. And one could take that as a symptom of something afoot more generally in culture. You see people sort of zoning out, whether it's students in the dorm rooms playing these games, etc. And then you have to ask, what is this about? You know, what's going on here? And one of the arguments that I make in my book is that there's a kind of frustration with the messages that we have internalized, that we should maximize our resources, and that if we act in certain ways, we can maximize our wealth, maximize ourselves. There's this whole sort of neoliberal rhetoric of self-maximization. And
so it's really seeing oneself, a human being, as a kind of economic construct.
Yes. Kind of a new version of what's called in economics, homo economicus.
Oh, Lord.
And I think, you know, I have my little cute phrase, homo addictus, but I think that sometimes homo economicus reveals itself to be a kind of homo addictus in certain contexts. And I think often, you know, if you look at what the possibilities and resources are for people out there to maximize themselves, they don't always live up to that imperative. And the frustrations of that and the failures of that can lead people to want to kind of escape. So what are they playing with? They're playing with money. They're playing with time. They're playing with all the things that they're supposed to be maximizing. And they're not maximizing when they're sitting in front of that machine. They're really escaping. And it's not about winning. If you really look at it, it's about staying in the zone as long as possible. And money is sort of converted into a means to an end of escape rather than something that they're driving at. So they kind of, you know, twist around the whole model of our culture, which is to win and maximize yourself.
Very interesting. And some of those people must really go broke. Other ones end up in Gamblers Anonymous. What makes them hit the breaking point where they want to stop and get out of this whole gambling pattern?
Often it really will be totally zeroing out their resources and getting to a point where they're forced to stop. I mean, that's the other driving aspect of this machinery is the idea that any kind of pause in play will open a space where the gambler can reflect and maybe will choose to self-stop. So if they can speed it up, there are less opportunities for gamblers to stop and reflect. This is why in Australia, where you have a somewhat similar situation, you see regulations now that called safe machines that will actually program on top of the game's regular functioning, like every 10 minutes. The screen will lock up and say, you know, you've been playing really fast for 10 minutes. You want to go take a break? So this is sort of, you see regulation inserting itself into these machines. That remains to be seen. It might, though. It really might, because it creates those little spaces for reflection. But your question was, what brings people to this point of actually stopping? And I think it is when they're totally zeroed out and they have no choice, really, but to seek help.
What are the similarities and differences to other kinds of alcohol and drug addiction? I mean, there's no overt tissue damage caused by chemicals, but other than that?
Yeah, I mean, there's no actual substance, so there could be, and there are debates over whether this really is a kind of addiction, and you have terms like process addiction and things like that. But within the addiction research community, it's becoming fairly accepted that this is a legitimate addiction, and in fact, some make the argument that it's almost like an exemplary form of addiction because you don't have the distraction of chemicals. As people have even gone so far as to call something like heroin an imposter molecule, whereas gambling gets directly into your brain and operates on endogenous chemicals. So it's a more intensified, distilled form of addiction, according to some researchers.
I was reading in your article, and there's, you know, far more that's going to be in your book that's coming out this fall, this year, descriptions of the players and what they like, and I was wondering if there was any chance that your work could actually help the gaming industry make even better games.
I have worried about that a lot myself. Like, how can my manual not read like a sort of what if it ends up in somebody's desk side table?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know that there's any way for me to know that. I have a feeling that it will be hopefully overlooked by the industry.
Did they know you were an anthropologist?
They did know that I was an anthropologist. And I approached them honestly about what I was doing and that I was interested in looking at games in culture and different kinds of gambling. And they understood that I was interested in the addiction side. And some of them even admitted to going to learn about addiction by attending some of the addiction workshops and even Gamblers Anonymous meetings throughout. So it wasn't like they weren't themselves already listening to gamblers and what they like. I mean, this is their whole life. So I'm not sure how much I would actually add to the knowledge that they already have. I think it'll serve more as a kind of critique and hopefully like bring out some of the contradictions that they sustain.
We're talking to Natasha Schull. Now, when I was growing up, we didn't have video games. We played ping pong and croquet and checkers and stuff like that. Kids today who have access to computers and all sorts of games. I mean, I got addicted a little bit to Tetris some years ago, and I had to deinstall it from my hard drive, only because I was getting tendonitis from it. But there are kids who are very good at all sorts of really sophisticated games. Does that make them basically potential future gambling addicts?
Well, the industry does regard the coming generations as being just ultra machine savvy kind of market. And they've been really surprised.
They could be savvy in a way that makes them skeptical.
They could, and perhaps that's going to happen. But I think there's such a familiarity with that kind of machinery where you just are playing with the machine at your own rhythm and pace and there's less interruptions and you can go into the zone. I think that kind of familiarity is a kind of priming and a sort of demand for those kind of games. And that's why, just over the past 20 years, machines have gone to bringing in 80% of revenue. Which is a dramatic increase from what it was just 20 years ago.
And all those card poker games at tables and stuff are now really small beans in comparison to the machines.
Well, it's interesting because in the past few years, there has been this sort of trend of live poker. And so you see it on ESPN, and kids all over are playing live poker. And so perhaps there is going to be a return to the more socially interactive kind of games. But in the casino, in terms of what is bringing in the money, it really is the technology and the machines. And table games themselves are being increasingly technologized.
So. Now, what about in New Mexico? We've got all these casinos just up the road. Are they using the same technology you're talking about? Do you know?
They are. I mean, you can go into, I think, any casino today, and you're going to see a significant number of machines. So they're really everywhere. You're going to have different markets, different kinds of machines. They're going to be set up in different ways. The rewards are going to be different for each market. But the basic structure of this entertainment that's supplied by technology is endemic in this context.
Well, Natasha Schull, it's time to go. Thank you so much for being with us on the
Thank
Radio
you.
Cafe. I'm delighted now to welcome Rabbi David Saperstein. He's both a rabbi and an attorney. He's director and counsel of the Religious Action Center of Reform Judaism in Washington, D.C., and he is the co-author of the book Jewish Dimensions of Social Justice, Tough Moral Choices of Our Time. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Delighted to be with you.
It's great to have you here. Now, your book is full of moral and ethical problems facing the world we live in, from medical, environmental, social, political issues. Jews and Gentiles are equally concerned with these issues. What is the Jewish angle? How are these issues made easier to deal with? Is it by the study of Old Testament, of Jewish scripture?
As with most of the religious groups in the United States, Mary Charlotte, we have a process that involves looking at our sacred texts that would include the Hebrew Scriptures, the Christian Old Testament, the rabbinic interpretations of those in the Talmud and the commentaries over the generations, the legal system of Judaism that try to apply the values of the Bible to the very real issues of poverty and health care and environmental protection going back thousands of years and consistently did so to draw ethical insights that can be helpful in the free marketplace of ideas in America, and that's a process that goes on.
Now, as you point out in the book, there are some places where we live in a modern world where scripture hasn't even begun to touch questions, for example, of complex technology and life-saving devices and things like that didn't exist even 100 years ago, much less several thousand.
Take the issue you were talking about with Linda Siegel, which is so interesting, of stem cell research.
For example.
The rabbis, the ancient Christian scholars never could have envisioned something like that. But they did set out a number of criteria that should be used to judge these kinds of application of scientific technology to the world. That the purpose is to make the world better. The purpose is to heal. We all have mandates in our tradition about using our God-given wisdom to heal. In the Jewish tradition, we have a particular stance that deals with the question of when life begins differently than some of the Christian strands, even in the most theologically traditional strands of Judaism. We have no idea that life begins at conception. Human life begins at conception. So there's universal support of, even in the most ultra-Orthodox circles, for stem cell research as a way to try to cure terrible diseases that afflict humankind and make their lives better. And we believe that's what God charges us to do.
What is the Jewish theological position on when life begins, and what texts does that come from?
There is a variety of... the only place in the Bible that in either of these scriptures that you have a specific reference to something directly on point is in Exodus, where it talks about two men striving, and if they injure a pregnant woman and she loses the fetus, that the penalty will not be a criminal penalty or death. It would be a monetary penalty, from which the rabbis in the Talmud, the time that Jesus lived, the writing down of an oral tradition and the interpretation and application of biblical laws to their world at that time, and through all the legal codes of the last 2,000 years, have continued to expand this idea in a consistent way that says human life does not begin at the moment of conception. There are different theories of when it begun, some a quickening 40 days, some viability. But to the very end, the realized life of the mother takes precedence. If in order to save the life of a mother, a fetus endangers that, and the only way to save the mother's life is for the fetus to be destroyed, it's actually a religious mandate to do that in the Jewish tradition. So even as I said, in the most strict Orthodox circles, it would be looked at very differently than the Catholic view would be looked at.
Now, there are some other examples in the book. I was interested to read the section on racism, and you talk about, I mean, every tradition says racism is a bad thing, but you give real-life modern examples of, for example, people fleeing to the suburbs from the inner city, and what are the ethical dimensions of that? I found that very interesting.
The book is actually structured that way. It interweaves a look at what the texts tell us about contemporary challenges we face, and then throughout the book, real-life decisions that had to be made by the religious communities of America, or in our case, by the National Reform Jewish Community and the 900 congregations with 1.5 million members who had to make decisions. We're doing this right now on the war in Iraq, having a debate with our board this Monday. We're the first Jewish group to take a position in opposition to the war in Iraq, and the question is, should we expand the position that we've taken? So we're always involved in doing this, and the book actually gives a lot of real examples. So, yes, we do talk about the white flight issue in the book, and there are moral obligation that even if people move away from the urban centers, that the destiny, the well-being, the strength of the educational, economic, and social systems of our urban centers are going to determine the whole future of this country. And you cannot, like Noah in the Ark, just turn your back, on what else is happening here. We have to confront what is happening in the world, no matter where we live. So, yes, you may move away. You may put your kid up for full-time Jewish education in a private school. But if you do, how much more so you have an obligation to engage with the public school systems of America, with the problems of the inner city, and to ensure that America works for all people. For, I think, one thing much of the Jewish community knows intuitively, having been one of them with African Americans, the quintessential victims of group hatred and deprivation and discrimination in Western history, is that if we live in any society that we live, if any group can be subject to persecution, discrimination, oppression, no group is safe, including the Jewish community. And it is not only in our moral interest, but our self-interest to ensure that justice and equality prevails in America.
Now, pretty much everybody I know, and without exception, everybody I know who grew up in a Reform Jewish context is very interested in social justice. It's part of the deal. What about Orthodox Judaism?
There are three strands that led to the particular emphasis Reform Judaism has. The core one of those three, all Jewish streams, including Orthodox Judaism, shares. One is God's mandate, that we be partners with God in shaping a better and more hopeful future for all God's children. That comes from the Bible's call for us to be a holy people and for Jews to be a light to the nations. How can we be a light to the nations if we turn our backs on the fundamental issues of peace in the world and economic justice here at home? So that sense of God, and in Leviticus, when it asks us, when God calls us to be a holy people, it tells us how to do that by setting aside a corner of the field for the poor and removing the stumbling block before the blind and setting up courts of justice and paying the labor a fair and timely wage. So it's absolutely clear that a God-given call is that. Now, Reform Judaism, building on that, really evolved in the 1900s in the middle of the Age of Reason, and Age of Reason philosophers emphasized that that which was most logical and rational about religion was ethics. So it took ethics to even a higher standpoint. And for Reform Jews, this was a key organizing principle of our Jewish identity, the sense of having a prophetic mission that so many other Christian groups share. The social gospel tradition in the Christian community was influenced by exactly the same factors that drove Reform Judaism's emphasis on this. So what we are passionate for social justice is central, and we share it with a lot of the Christian community and other communities as well.
And atheist communities and Buddhist communities and basically anybody who's interested in a compassionate stand toward one another.
Indeed, but the source of it for all those different groups comes from their distinct experience. For Jews, what we learn around the Seder table when we retell the story of freedom, what we learn lighting the Hanukkah menorah and learn about religious liberty in the Maccabees' heroic battle against the Greek oppression over 2,000 years ago, what we learn every Sabbath and talking about what a world of peace means. This is the way that we help convey that generation to generation. Every group has its distinct way of doing it, but it doesn't make one group's ideas better than anyone else's. All we can do is draw from the richness of our tradition and put it out in the free marketplace of ideas. This was, for example, the genius of the Catholic bishops' pastoral letters on nuclear disarmament and on global warming and economic justice. They drew from distinct Catholic doctrine to say, here are the ethical norms, and in our natural law source of authority in Catholicism that's accessible to anyone, even if they don't accept Catholic dogma, here's how we think these should be applied. Not suggesting Catholic law is binding upon America, but rather a moral goad to the conscience of the country with great ethical insight. And all religious traditions do that, and that's what we're part of undertaking in America today.
We're talking to Rabbi David Saperstein, and he's co-author of the book Jewish Dimensions of Social Justice, Tough Moral Choices of Our Time. I have to say, reading the book, one gets the sense that there's a lot of committees and arguments and conversations and negotiation and stuff that went into coming up with the responses and positions that are in the book. What was the process like?
It's because of whom I work for. I work for a national religious denomination. So we have structures, just like the Presbyterians and the Methodists and the Islamic Society of North America and the national Sikh groups. All groups, you know, those who organize in national faith group entities, they have structures. So yes, a lot of the book talks about the action, because I try to exemplify real decisions that we had to make and try to honestly assess where we succeeded and where we failed. These were tough battles within the conventions and the board meetings of our national denomination.
What are some of the kind of arguments that you had? I mean,
we took a position against the Vietnam War several years before any of other national Jewish organizations did. By the end of the war, all of them had come out with a position against the war. But it led to some of our largest congregations leaving the movement for a while, for a few years, and then they came back and rejoined over that during the debates over civil rights, where many of our rabbis were down working and organizing in the South and were marching with Dr. King. Many of our congregations in the South were deeply resentful and almost led to splits for us.
But what about more recently? In other words, some of the ideas and ethical, moral decisions that went into this book.
Right now, when we were preparing for the vote that's going to happen Monday on the war in Iraq and whether we're going to oppose the surge and call for a specific timetable by which time American troops should withdraw, 14 months ago, as I said, we became the first national Jewish organization, and still the only, to take a position on the war one way or the other, but in our case, to come out against the war. We're now trying to address what's happened in the last 14 months. A month ago, we put this out across the country, the copy of the resolution, asking all of our congregations to have open forums, discussions, give us feedback. hundreds and hundreds of people, rabbis, presidents, board members of our congregations, average members of our congregations, have written us with their ideas of what this resolution ought to do and what this resolution ought to say. Some are outraged that we are doing this, in the same that people are outraged we took a position on civil rights in the Vietnam War, saying it's not religious. We say that if you look at what the prophets say and the entirety of the biblical tradition and the idea of ethical monotheism, it is profoundly and deeply not only religious, but at the center of our religion and what God calls us to do. Others took issue with specific things. Some wanted us to go further, calling for a cutting off of funding right now to the war. So our entire country, all across America, our synagogues have been involved for the last month in this fascinating debate and rich debate that will animate the decisions that we're going to make on Monday.
Now, what about peace as a value in itself? Would you say that Judaism is an inherently pacifist religion?
Judaism does not have the same strand of pacifism that the modalities of turn the other cheek from the New Testament led to in Christian life. There's a much stronger strand of pacifism in Christianity than there is in Judaism. It was never the majority in Christianity, but it's a strong minority strand in Christian thought. And in Judaism, the idea of a moral use of force, similar to Christian just war theory, that Augustine and Aquinas developed in Catholic doctrine. We developed, going back to the Bible, in Deuteronomy, there are rules about the rules of law, and 2,000 years ago in the Talmud, these got developed into very specific rules about what's allowed and what's not allowed, what's a just cause to fight a war and what isn't, what's the right authority to fight a war and what is not. And we believe, particularly based on the Bible's mandate, that if you see someone pursuing another person to harm them, you are obligated, so long as you don't risk or injury or your own life, to intervene even physically, to stop an innocent person from being hurt. Based on that, we always believed that there is a moral use of force. On the other hand, the term shalom, its root l'shalem in Hebrew, does not mean what pax means in Latin, the absence of strife or war. It means to make whole, to heal, to make complete. And we understood at the same time that there was moral use of force. Its goal was to bring peace that would be a peace of wholeness, of healing to communities. The rabbis told us 2,000 years ago, the sword enters the world because of justice delayed and justice denied. So we see this all being integrated, that peace is the goal. It requires justice, equality, fairness, compassion. But sometimes along the way, when you face people who intend to do evil, you have to respond with force to protect innocent people.
It's funny because that type of doctrine comes from examples that have to do with saving one individual human from another individual human. When you start getting to the scale of governments and armies, the whole game changes. And people, when they have a big army, when they want things, they can interpret scripture. They can use scripture for their own ends.
People, just like lawyers, can use the same law to argue for both sides of a case. People use scripture to argue for both sides of a case. There's nothing implicitly wrong with that. In the Talmud, we recorded majority and minority opinions, kind of this first structured free marketplace of ideas, because the rabbi said what was a minority opinion at one point, a generation later they may see the wisdom of and believe that it ought to be the majority opinion. So it was important to record diversity of viewpoints and ensure freedom of speech. So yes, people will use scripture differently. It's true on an individual basis as well as on a group basis. But in the end, the majority of the sages made a decision about how to apply the law that became the rule, the law for the Jewish communities. In the end, we had to use our wisdom to make the best decision possible. It's true in politics today. It's true as we apply the religious tradition to the world. I'm sure on the bishops' committee on the pastoral letters, there were minority viewpoints that differed with what the final decision. But in the end, We make decisions. We don't try to pretend. We speak for all our members, all our rabbis, all our priests, all our ministers, all our board members, all our presidents of churches and synagogues. But we do speak for the consensus of the decision-making processes of our movement, fulfilling our mandate to be a prophetic witness and a moral goad to the conscience of the country. And I think the country is much richer for that.
Now, what is, in other words, when you live in a country that has, like ours, a separation or supposed separation of church and state, and then a religious organization takes a position, what does that actually do?
What the founders were concerned about, you know, this is part of the field that I teach as a lawyer for 27 years. I've been on the faculty of Georgetown Law School, where I teach church-state law. So it's into your question goes to an issue that's a passion of mine, and I've written on extensively. What the founders really were concerned about was creating a wall that was primarily a one-way wall on a functional level. It prevented government from interfering with religion, but it did almost nothing to prevent religion from having all the same rights of freedom of speech, freedom of publication, freedom of association, freedom to petition the government for redress of grievances, what we call lobbying, that all the any other form of expression or organization had. So long as the church doesn't have access to government power, that's the limitation on the church. You can't use government power to impose your views on people, but you can be a moral goad to the conscience of the country, and I think that's one of the reasons that the framers kept government out of religion, to allow it to flourish here and to be able to speak freely without government manipulation and control.
So when your organization speaks freely without government manipulation or control, what good does it do? What does it do? What effect does it have? Any effect at all?
Oh, I think it has an enormous effect. If you listen to debates on the war in Iraq in 1990, the Gulf War, the debates over Bosnia and Kosovo and whether we ought to intervene, it was filled with dress war talk, with people citing on the floor of the Senate and the House citing religious authorities as to when is just cause to intervene to save innocent people. And I think, you know, on the civil rights movement, on the environmental movement now, that I think is one of the most intuitively religious issues of our time, the notion that we're obligated to protect God's creation, I think the moral voice of the religious community has had a profound impact on the history of America, and continues to have a profound impact, but no more or less than anyone else. It's the strength of its reasoning that makes it effective. It is not that religion ever should have the ability to use the coercive power of government to impose its views on America. It can only persuade people by moral suasion that its view is right, and then, like any other democratic decision our representatives make, they vote to enact it or they vote not to enact the views that the church has espoused.
So a little holding up a little candle of rationality in the darkness, essentially.
I think of it more as ethical insight, but yes, I think that's exactly what we do. And of course, religions are not the only source of it. They're one of many rich sources of wisdom and ethical insight in the great debates that shape America.
Well, Rabbi Saperstein, it's wonderful to have you on. I wish we could have had more time today. Thanks so much for being with us here on KSFR.
Well, you're welcome. It's a real pleasure to talk with you and your listeners.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.